The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2017 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2017. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
My name is Dr. Marcus Ross. I'm a professor at Liberty University, where I teach earth science, geology, and paleontology. I'm also the director of the Center for Creation Studies at Liberty University. So I'm a fossils and rocks guy, and we advocate a young earth creation at Liberty University. And I'm also here with Cornerstone Educational Supply, which is a business that my wife and I started just 2 years ago to provide educational rock, mineral, fossil supplies, and other science materials from a Christian and creation perspective to the Christian education community. So as I looked around, and I've been using rock boxes and things like that in my classes and my courses and taught from them when I was an undergraduate, I kept looking at them saying, these are really good. And we don't have anything in Christianity that affirms faith along with that, that glorifies God as the creator of these amazing materials that we have, the fossils that are out there. And we need something like that. So finally got off my duff and began. So today I'm going to give a talk called Mineral Mayhem. So for those of you who, how many of you are science teachers? Every hand goes up. Yay. Just about. Almost every hand. Okay. So welcome, and I'm glad that you came. This is intended to be something that's going to be fun. It's going to be a little bit of hands-on. I'm going to need some audience participation as we go, because I want to model for you something that you can then take back to your school, take back to your classes, and do with them. Hopefully with even more enthusiasm than I have, because you guys teach smaller kids than I teach. You know, I've got to kind of do the dogged pony show at college, but I don't have to be like, and now kids, here's what we're going to do. Right. You know, that's, I have to do that with my children, because they're like, Dad, more rocks? Really? Like, yeah. No, I know. Oh, that's all right. So what I've got here is some of the information that I'm getting is from this textbook, The Heavens and the Earth. This is a brand new earth science textbook co-authored by myself. My two co-authors from Cedarville University are Dr. John Whitmore, who's also a geologist, and Dr. Steve Golmer. He is atmospheric science and meteorology. And then Danny Faulkner, Dr. Danny Faulkner, is at Answers in Genesis, and he's the astronomer with them. So the four of us have all been college professors for a very long time and decided that the college level needed an earth science textbook from a distinctly Christian and, in particular, young earth creation perspective. So we teamed together with that. Now, one of the chapters that I wrote was the minerals chapter. So as I'm going to be giving this talk, a good bit of what we'll be seeing are kind of, you know, what I'm going to be presenting is some of the material that's in that textbook. And though this is a college textbook, it's a college textbook that is written for general education, right? It's written for students who otherwise are fearful of biology and chemistry and physics, and so what could be so bad about learning about rocks? So that's the large proportion of the students that I get in my classes. How many don't like biology? How many didn't want to do math? Hey, right, you know, so that's what I get. So the first thing to think about, though, is before we get into the mayhem of the minerals, is why do we even care, right? What is it about minerals that deserves our attention? I was in the session earlier today with Dr. Doug Wilson, and one of the things that I appreciated about what he was saying is that, you know, we have to have a passion for God in order to have a passion for the things that he has made, so that we can give that passion to our students, whom we should also have a passion for, right? A love for God, a love for his world, and a love for the people that God has given to us to educate, and the responsibility that we have. And so one of the things that a lot of times when you're doing classwork in minerals and rocks and things like that, you've got to learn granite. Okay. You have to learn basalt. You have to learn quartz and feldspar. You have to learn these basic materials. Why? Because they're basic. That's boring, right? Okay, so why do we need to learn about quartz? What is it that quartz does for us? So one of the things that I do with my students is I ask them this question. I say, okay, take a look around the room that we're in right now, this room. Just take a moment. Go ahead. Take a minute and look around at the items that we have out. Ceiling fixtures, false ceiling paneling, wood trim, doors, electrical outlets, Nobody's on their cell phone right now. That's good. That's encouraging. 5 minutes later, it's getting boring. All right. So as we look around at the room, at the materials that are in a speaker or in our chairs, how many of these things came from something that was mined? And the answer is lots of it. Right? In the mining industry, they've got this fun saying, if you can't grow it, you have to mine it. And that's really true. Because everything that's around here, from the drywall that's making up some of this ceiling stuff, it's made of the mineral gypsum. Right? It's called gyprock or gypsum board or rock board, you know, stuff like that. Okay, so gypsum has got to be important as a mineral because this sheetrock is everywhere, right? So it's useful to us. So what are the stuff that's in here that's made of metallic resources? Well, the chairs that we're sitting on have got a metal framing. There's metal in the computer and in the microphone. We've got magnets and we've got other sorts of things around here that are all metal resources. Then you have to think for a minute, well, what are some of the non-metallic resources, right? Metals are pretty easy to figure out. But then the non-metallic stuff, that's when you start getting into the gypsum board. That's when you start getting into the plastics. I mean, good heavens, when you think about all the plastic that's out there, for good and for ill, right? Plastic is a wonderful material, and it's a byproduct of the petroleum industry. It's leftover stuff that we could reprocess and turn into stuff. Now, do we have organic plastics as well, plant-based plastics? We do. But by far, most of it is coming from the oil industry. Right? It's coming from petroleum, feedstocks from other sorts of stuff. So as we look around, it turns out that there's a lot there. Even a lot of the carpeting is made from plastic material. It comes from petroleum, right? So we got a lot of different stuff around us, right? So you have your kids in the class, you know, pull out something that's in their pocket and start looking at it. You know, and what's made of mined minerals that's in your pocket, that's on your clothing right now. And start looking at the sneakers. Sorry, I've got flip-flops here, but I prefer not to wear anything at all, but people look at me weird. So anyway, so the next question is, okay, so a lot of stuff gets mined. Metals and non-metals get mined, and we've got different categories. I don't have a slide for that right now. I cut it for time, but you know, you could start going through, these are the different sorts of things that we mine, and then these are the different sorts of things that we get for non-mineral or non-metal materials, like crushed stone and things like that. But how much do we use? And the answer is a whole big lot. We use a lot more material per year that comes from mined resources than you'd probably think about. So there's the chart, and I'll just highlight down here the bottom number. 18,027 kilograms per person per year. Per person per year. That is nearly 40,000 pounds of mined materials per person per year. So Carolyn, who's sitting here in the front, you are responsible for about 38,000 pounds of mined materials this year. I'm not going to make you apologize for that. You might be a dwarf, right? I mean, you're mining, just constantly mining, right? That's right. There you go. Right. I mean, the tunnel, the pit tunnel, that's, you know, bored right through the opposite side of the river here in Pittsburgh. You know, they had to remove all of that. Where did that stuff go? Oh, it got crushed up and turned into some of the road aggregate, probably. Or some of it might have been shaley material that's really no good to use, and that might have just been disposed of somewhere else or put into some type of other filler, landfill type of stuff. But when we think about, wow, rock and mineral resources, what's making up the bulk here? Well, the bulk is coming up from sand, gravel, and crushed stone. Every single mile of highway has got something like 200 tons of rock in it. Probably even more than that. It might be larger amounts than that. But we use a whole lot of sand and gravel and crushed stone. Crushed stone is really heavy. I know because I have a lot of it in my basement for making the rock kits that we do for Cornerstone. I have 3 tons of rocks and minerals and fossils in my basement. It doesn't take up as much space as you'd think, but it does take up a lot of space, but not as much as you might think. So we use a lot of that whenever we're making highways, whenever we're making roads, whenever we're sinking a foundation. So start getting the kids thinking about, well, how much, you know, how many of you live in a house that has a basement? Raise their hand, right? And you guys raise your hand. You might be looking at something like 40 tons of rock to make that basement. It's less if you live on a slab and there's no basement, if it's just concrete pad. But if you've got a basement, you're probably looking at somewhere between 40 and 80 tons. So we use a lot of this stuff. What else do we use a lot of? energy. So a lot of the rest of it is coming up from our energy resources. Coal, each one of us individually responsible for 2,200 kilograms, right? So nearly about 4,700 pounds or so. So we're talking 2 tons, 2.5 tons worth of this stuff. Same thing for natural gas if we converted it into poundage and so on and so forth. The good one down here is uranium. Each one of us is only responsible for 0.1 kilograms of uranium per person per year. That's not that much, but all of that's going to make electricity for us and hopefully not anything else, right? Because that's bad, bad stuff. So what I want to start in here now would be, okay, you've taught your kids a little bit about minerals, and now what you want to do is get them a little more hands-on with minerals themselves. So we're going to start off with what we call a seed crystal. And we're going to do that using toys. Because I want to give you something that you can do no matter where you are. So I need 4 volunteers to come up to the front. All right, 1, 2. We have Liz and Jason and Gail. Come on up. One more person, want to join him? Yes, in the back. All right. So we have Jason, Liz, Gail, and Tori. Welcome. So what schools are you coming from?
Why don't you... Class school in Williamsburg, Virginia.
Okay.
Westside Christian Academy.
New Covenant Schools in Lynchburg.
In Lynchburg, yes. All right. Well, great. So you guys are our students here, right, in this case. So I'm the teacher. We've been talking about minerals. We've been talking about crystals. Now we're going to start talking about how minerals form. And in order to do that... What I want you to do is pick a number between 1 and 4, Liz.
2.
Second thing that I saw in here was this.
3.
Duplos.
1.
You get connects. And Tori, you get the last one. All right. I don't know what those are, but they're big. Right. And I'll take 1. A puzzle. No doubt there are building toys to be found at your school somewhere, right? Or at home. And so what I want you guys to do, just start making stuff. And this is total free-form activity. I don't care what it is, as long as it's appropriate, right? For That's right. That's a brand new package. I haven't even opened that yet, so. All right. Let's see. I got cute little... What's on this? It's not Disney. I don't know what this is. So, right. I mean, thinking about this as an educator, you give your kids a whole bunch of puzzle pieces or you give them Lego bricks or things like that, and you tell them to just do stuff, okay, you're going to be able to grade something for a little while. Right? This is... Okay, you're going to be able to step outside... Take a breather, go down to the water fountain, you know, whatever it is that you need to do, right? So this is an opportunity for you to take a little bit of a break inside that class period and start letting them do a little bit hands-on, right? Especially if it's, you know, if it's part of that day where kids start getting a little fidgety and stuff like that. So what we've got here are different sorts of, my goodness, that's going to be large, whatever it is. I know, no. Right, and no matter what I do, mine's going to be flat. I mean, it's just, you know, I got puzzle pieces. That's it. Yeah. Connects are rather versatile. So you can... See, and then you get the other kids teaching the other kids how to play with their stuff. I mean, your job is so easy. So easy with this, right? Oh, wow, okay, you must teach biology because that's reminding me of a benzene ring right there. It is a benzene ring. Yes, all right. Fantastic, I'll get the other sticks. Let's see, because if we're going to do this right as a benzene ring, right, we got to get one here. No, it's aromatic hydrocarbons at a geology talk. I wasn't expecting this. Okay, so let's take a look. You just destroyed everything and started over again. So... What we do with this part of the activity is the kids get out there, okay, they've built stuff. And the thing is that something like this ball and stick thing and the dominoes, right, they just don't work together at all. And there's no way that I'd be able to take the dominoes and try and, you know, stick them in here or anything like that, right? I might be able to use some of the balls as platforms, but they're incompatible. And likewise, the Kinects and the Legos are incompatible, except for a couple of brilliant people who decided to create connector pieces between them, right? So that was smart. But what we do with an activity like this is that the students get several things that are very, very different, and they make different sorts of shapes. And that's what minerals basically are at the atomic level, right? They're different materials making different kinds of shapes. And it all starts out with what we call a seed crystal. Okay, so a seed crystal is the first tiny crystal that gets formed as a mineral starts to form out of a fluid. Okay. Now, that fluid could be something like a magma, right? If we're thinking about a granite as a type of a rock, the granite starts off as this molten material, and as it cools, it begins to precipitate out crystals of different chemistry. But this also works the same way if we're thinking about something that's happening in water. If you've got water and salt in it, and you dissolve out you've dissolved your salt in, and then you start to boil it out, right? And the salt crystals start to form. They're doing the same thing. They start off with a tiny little seed crystal. And the seed crystals then set the pattern for anything else. So if I had just started off by giving you one piece of those and then dumped out, this is another way you could do it, you could give each kid one different type of block, and then you've got this big tub that's got all different stuff. They have to rummage through. That's probably even more fun to do, right? Because now they got to start finding it and building it, and that's what's going on in a granite, right? It's basically the atoms have got to find the right matches as they are precipitating out with the other atoms, and it's a chaotic mess for a little while until you start getting things organized. Now, some of you are like, no, I'm going to give each of the students exactly what they, right, you know, different personalities and that sort of thing. So we get the students building stuff, and then they start realizing, okay, I have incompatible toys, and minerals sometimes have materials that are incompatible. The reason that gold is often found in veins within granites is because gold actually won't combine with anything, and it gets left behind as actually like scum. It's rock scum. Very pretty rock scum, very useful rock scum, very expensive rock scum. But it is the scum that's left over after everything else has been used. The gold just forms a vein, if you're lucky enough to find one. Okay. So the growth continues of these sorts of things. If we had this big box, right, the kids would just keep on building and keep on building until they run out of stuff. And for some of you, that would be sooner. And for others of you, right, there's actually a lot of stuff in this Kinect, right? This is quartz. This is quartz. It's here. There's so much of it. So much quartz. So our seed crystals get us started. The rest of the activity is building out your minerals, and then you're left with different types of shapes, which minerals come in different sorts of shapes as well. And these different materials can help students relate in kind of an analogous way, right? A metaphor, thinking again of this morning's talk. As a metaphor for the different properties of minerals. So if I built out my puzzle pieces lay out flat and thin like this. This is perfect for understanding something like muscovite and biotite mica. The mica flakes are packed nice and flat all the time, whereas some of these others are three-dimensional structures that are more like our big chain or three-dimensional silicate minerals, things like quartz and feldspar, and so on and so forth. So great, you guys can have a seat. We might bring up some more people in a little bit. Thank you for your participation. And you can just leave that stuff right there. Oh, you had a casualty? Oh, something busted? Oh, no. You'll have to leave. Come here, break my things. And that's all right. My kids are done playing with that stuff anyway. So that's why it's here. So, all right. So when we start thinking then about making the transition from an activity like this, which obviously could, you know, take 5 or 10 minutes or more with the kids, depends on how much time you need for coffee, right? or how much gossip's happening in the hallway, I don't know. So we start thinking about these different sorts of shapes and the chemistry that underlies them. Okay. So that gets us into what exactly is a mineral. Now there's over 5,100 minerals that have been identified. And actually, there's more of them out there that are awaiting confirmation on that. There's about 5,400, so there's about 300 more in the pipeline right now that are waiting to be formalized and recognized. Now, of those over 5,000, there's really only about 80 minerals that are common and probably only less than 50 that you would ever encounter in normal life. Probably somewhere around 30 or 40 that you would encounter in normal life. But nonetheless, we get an idea, and if you've taught earth science before, yes, a mineral is a naturally occurring object that's crystalline, solid, generally inorganic, and has a definite chemical formula. Right? And we can go through slides of you know, talking about each one of those. But that's what a mineral is. It is the foundational thing that is these atoms strung together in a certain way that provides it with certain physical attributes and properties so that we know how it's going to behave in a fairly regular fashion. Right? And therefore, then a rock, when we're trying to get into rocks, we talk about minerals as the building blocks of rocks. Well, we're using real building blocks to get an idea that when we finally do pick up a piece of a granite, and we can identify in there that there's a little piece of a quartz, or there's a small feldspar crystal in there, that I can see some black biotite mica. Okay, we've gotten to the point where we can do that because we're starting to understand what the minerals are. Now, building according to the rules here starts with what you were given, whether it was Lego bits or balls and sticks and things like that, and the same thing happens with the minerals. The building happens according to, in this case, chemical rules, and depending on when you're teaching earth science and how much chemistry, you can get into the valence electrons, right, and the octet rule, that atoms, as they form bonds, are trying to fill the outermost shell of their electrons, trying to get eight in there, and they're going to do that in a variety of different sorts of ways. So even if we're not at that level, if the students haven't taken that much chemistry, you can just say that the atoms are going to combine, and they're going to combine in certain ways depending on what atoms they are. And so you can bring up the periodic table and note that, for example, we get something like salt, right? Salt is sodium chloride. We got sodium, which is all the way over here, and it's a metal. We don't usually see it as metal because it's very unstable and oxidizes so quickly, but some of you have those fun little samples of sodium, right, and it's inside of like a mineral oil in order to keep it safe. It's great. Then somebody throws it in the pool and there's a little fire, and that's great. So you've got the sodium on one end, and you've got chlorine on nearly the exact opposite end, right, and it's plus one, minus one on the charges. They stick together kind of like magnets, and they build out a square crystal structure. So over here we've got the chemical structure of halite, sodium chloride with sodium in the blue and the chlorine in the yellow, and cool crystals of halite. I've got 3 5-gallon buckets of halite from the Detroit salt mines, which is great. These really big honking crystals I whack down to get into our kits. But if you email me, I can get you one of the nice big huge ones. And yes, it's salty as all get out. It's just a giant cube of salt. I always do that in front of my students. Don't be afraid to do that, right? If you got salt in your class, if you buy rocks, how many of you use rock salt? Okay? Right? It says non-edible, right, or do not eat. It's salt. It's salt. It's not like they put bugs in it, right? If they did, they just put preserved bugs because they just got salted, right? But, you know, I'm up there with my students, and some minerals have taste to them. It's like, give it a big old lick, okay? Put on a show, right? And the students, yeah. But remember, with salt, the trick is you can do that with salt because salt is the cleanest mineral in your box. Nothing on earth can live on a cube of salt. There is no bacterium alive that can survive this. So you can hand that one around, kids can lick it, and they're not going. You know, it's going to be a little weird, but weird's good. Weird's really good when playing around with rocks and minerals, as you can see. But you know, when you lick the quartz and it doesn't taste like anything. Oh, okay, maybe that was a mistake. Shouldn't have done the lick test on that one. So this gets us into the mineral properties. All right, and so for mineral properties, what we want to do is start figuring out, if we're given a mineral, what sort of ways it behaves. So as I rebox up some of this stuff here for a moment, I'll flip over to the next slide just so you have something that's there. Right, we've got different kinds of properties that are organized according to different sorts of things. So, for example, you might not see a list like this because the first thing that we might think of with properties is things like taste and acid reaction and things like that. But they can also be grouped into a couple of larger sets. So we're thinking about the properties such as optical properties, all things about how we see the mineral, the way light reflects off of them, a category of things that all deal with optics. Another category that all deals with the mineral shapes. And here's where I need a few more people who want to be volunteers, so we'll split this up. Four more people who'd like to come on up. Oh, you saw what I did to the last one, so now you don't want to do it. Come on, who's going to be adventuresome? Okay, there's one, or I'll pick the next couple people who don't look at me. That's it. Two, three, four. Okay, great. I'm not going to like, you know, spritz you with acid or anything like that. That's for my students. No, I'm just kidding. All right. Oh, yeah, yeah, by all means, have a seat. We're just going to, you want to put these things back in their little bags. Then that way I can give you some other stuff. So as we think about this, one of the things, of course, to instill in the students as we're talking to them is the wonder of the creation that we have been given with, that we've been given and blessed with. That these materials, like I said at the beginning, aren't just there because they need to be. There are certain things that, you know, kind of seem to be necessary. We need some hard rocks around, otherwise the surface of the earth is gushy and living here is difficult. So hard things are good. Sandstone, granites, helpful. But why do we need garnet? Why do we need diamond? Why do we need things that are beautiful? Right? There are some things in this world that are just extra, that bespeak of a creator who not only wants to furnish us with the things that we need, but is over and abundant in his desires to give us things that are beautiful. Right? You look at some of the flowers out there, and we need some flowers in order to make fruit. That's great. But there are some flowers that are just dang beautiful for the sake of being beautiful. And so as we talk with our students about these sorts of things, we can use the opportunities to pull out a really pretty set of minerals, right? And show them that there's quartz, which has a certain, you know, look to it. But then there's rose quartz, and there's smoky quartz, and there's citrine, and there's amethyst, and there's carnelian. And there's all these varieties out there that don't have to be there. There's nothing in the universe that requires this. But they're here anyway. And amethyst is one of my favorites, not because, not just because I'm born in February. Actually, purple's not my favorite color. But amethyst is a great mineral story because up until the late 1800s, amethyst was probably the fourth most expensive mineral in the world. After rubies, diamonds, sapphires was amethyst. And it wasn't until Brazil's mining industry got started really in the mostly 1900s that all of a sudden this stone, which was so rare, was found in such massive quantities in Brazil that a stone that formerly was only in the domains of kings and pharaohs is now something that we can get on a pendant for $20 at Walmart. Kind of amazing. And again, it doesn't have to be that way. There's nothing in the world that says we need to have a little bit of titanium inside our quartz. No, God says, I want there to be a little titanium inside the quartz because this is just going to be cool. And when you find it, you're going to be blown away. All right. So now you guys get to play with some of the actual minerals that we've got. So just pulled up one of our kits from Cornerstone. This is our deluxe mineral set. And the first thing that I do with my students, I'm going to ask you the same that you do. Organize it. However you want, or however you think a 13-year-old would. Like, sparkly, right? Because most of the, yeah, that's right, most of the girls, I teach earth science at Liberty University and geology, and when I do this, a lot of the students that I have are elementary education majors, and they're taking earth science because, again, they don't want physics, and they're given the option of physics, chemistry, earth science. So I have a popular class by default. And so I tell them, I give them a box of rocks, and we don't talk about any of these properties yet, nothing like that at all. This is a great activity for any age. So if you're teaching five-year-olds in kindergarten, hand them a box of minerals and say, put them together by groups of twos or threes or fours. Or I just don't, put them in whatever groups you want. I don't care how many groups, I don't, as long as there's more than one. Right? It's like, what's that group? My box of rocks. Not helpful. Right. So, you know, put them in a couple of groups. This, again, gives you an opportunity to go to the bathroom for the first time in the day, right? You know, it's... And what's fun is you just keep getting different groups, right? Every kid gets to kind of do it their own way. Every group of students gets to group them their own way. And every year that I've done this for quite some time, there's still, you know, one group that always ends up doing something a little different. Same box of rocks I've been working at, you know, for 12 years. And somebody's like, oh, I put all these together. Why'd you do that? Because all of them looked, you know, this way. So what's a couple of our, let's check in on our students here. What's a couple of our groupings? Each one of you take a moment to say, I grouped these and this is why. Oh, okay. Okay, so we picked up. Yeah, no, oh, absolutely, yeah. Yay, we're teaching this right. So we picked up our pyrite and our copper, native copper from Michigan. And these are metallic. They look metal-y. Yeah, absolutely. What's in your group, Nancy? As far as.
Mm-hmm.
Earthy. Okay, great. So yeah, you get some rocks that, you know, just or some minerals, and you're like, what is it? And somebody says, it's a rock. Like, no, remember, rocks are made up of minerals. But anyway, yeah, these ones sort of shiny, but sort of not, or not in the same way. Weird, different, right? So what do we have over here? Okay, so we got a couple of minerals. Hard for you guys to see them here, but thin, flat, flaky. One's black, one's clear-ish. This used to be used as window pane if you couldn't afford glass. So muscovite mica was poor man's glass, and still is used in some things like wood-burning stoves, pellet stoves, because it's tremendously good at heat retention. So the glass will melt and break and become, you know, really dangerous. Muscovite will do just fine. This muscovite actually comes from Virginia, Moorefield Mine. If you've ever been to the Smithsonian, how many of you have been to the Smithsonian? Okay, visit the mineral gallery that's up there. They have like this, it's spectacular. And they've got like this pretend mine that you go in. That pretend mine is based off of the Moorefield Mine, which is about 30 minutes outside of Richmond, Virginia. And it's been mined, ever since the 1920s or so, had a lot of activity in World War II, where they were mining the mica for wartime apparatus materials, things like that. Okay, and we got these two other groups. What else are in these groups? Okay, so the dullest minerals. Okay, the dullest minerals, we've got this kind of spiky ball sort of thing. We've got this other thing which has these weird circles in it, something that's just kind of rusty, and then this gray, very, very smooth, extremely smooth clay. This is kaolin clay. This is the clay that is used to make porcelain, but also used in facial makeups as well. It is extremely soft, beautiful, feels great. I use it daily. It's also used as a paint filler. It's a very good thickening agent here. So we got a couple of things going on with these. So great. Again, you know, it's a 5-minute activity that you can do with your students. You get them hands-on. They're working with the stuff. I haven't given anybody any materials to test the stuff yet, right? And yet already they've become interested in the rocks, and hopefully the students, right? They become interested in the rocks. They're making observations. Most of the observations that they're making are first about the optical properties, right? Because, of course, the first thing that we do when we look at something is we see it and its color and its reflectivity and those sorts of things. So those optical properties are the very first components of any sort of observation that's going to be done. And anything after that is going to be secondary, right? It's going to be more hands-on. We have to now scratch it or, you know, sniff it or scratch and sniff it and see what happens with the sulfur, right? Those types of things. So the next thing that we get to do is open up one of our testing kit materials and have you guys work in pairs. And you can hand these things out for that first activity as well, or you can kind of hold off, again, if you need to use the restroom, and go ahead and open up those boxes and bags. And again, another free-form activity for students. You just give them stuff and let them play. Right? Something we don't do a lot in our classes is play. But play is a tremendously important component of learning. Think of all the things as a kid that you learned to do because you were playing. You learned to throw a ball. You learned to kick something. You learned to run. You learned to ride a bike. Why? Because somebody was telling you and holding your hand and saying you had to do it this way, or you read a textbook about riding a bike first? No. You did it because it was fun. You did it because it was interesting. You did it because it made you feel good. Right? So giving people a whole bunch of stuff and saying play is neat. So a couple of you have a hand lens. How many of you have used a hand lens before? Okay. So with the hand lens, in case you haven't seen one of these before, jeweler's loop. Okay. A lot of times we have the little plastic magnifiers in classes. These are more fun. Right? So you bring it all the way up to your eyelashes. And then you take what you want to look at, you bring it ridiculously close to your face. Right, to the point where one of the other jerk kids in junior high slaps you in the, thanks. That was my life. Anyway, I love junior high. I especially love the part about graduating and getting away. So that's, you give them stuff like this to use, so they get better with those optical views. And now they're given things like nails, pennies, streak plates, little dropper bottles. If those have acid in them, right? You can use vinegar or you can use hydrochloric acid. For homeschoolers, typically vinegar, since not a lot of people have hydrochloric acid sitting around, because that's good that they don't. So we teach our students, once they've got their optical properties, some of them will divide things out by shape, right? They'll start to say, well, these are all the minerals that were flat. Okay, that was one of the categories that we saw. I mean, I also see people that say, these look like they have good prisms. They've got a nice quartz crystal in there, or these have flat surfaces, right? Things like that are shape-related. Some of them will heft them and discover that some of them are really dense and heavy, so we put all the dense and heavy ones together. So these are all the big categories. Yeah, question, Carolyn.
My daughter just graduated eighth grade with a minor in my class. She took some really dirty money and she decided to...
Yeah. And fun little science experiment. I'm going to clean this. Well, okay, that didn't work quite right. Instead, the penny is kind of gone. And so, for example, we like to put nice shiny pennies in our testing kits, because it's really nice when you open up something and you got this really pretty looking penny. So since I can't go to the mint all the time in order to get that, we take our pennies. And in order to clean them, vinegar is great. You also need salt, and you need to you need to dilute the vinegar a little bit. And then we put it into a little rotary vibrator, like kind of a rock tumbler sort of thing, but instead of the tumbles that way, it shakes them. And you do that for about a half hour. So, the whole day in the sun, that's a little rough on the penny. Half hour acid bath, that's more like exfoliation. Okay, that's, yes, everything is nice and smooth, looks good. Not all of this is planned, folks, what I'm about to say. It's. I tell my students that jokes in my classes are like getting ramen noodles from Sam's Club. Okay, you're going to get a big load of them. It's going to be unending, but none of it's good for you. Okay, there's no nutritional value here. The end is like, it tasted like MSG. But anyway, so we go over, once we've got that sort of stuff and the kids have got to play, then we get to introduce how they've been playing and that their play has names and their play has meaning. And that all of this is to help us discover properties about these items so that we can understand God's world better. Right? Not only what it is, because that's the first question that we ask, is what is this? And when we think about our three stages, right, that grammar stage is all about what is it? And no matter what stage we are in life, we're always going through these three stages. We have to learn the grammar of where we are. You get a new job, there's a whole new set of words. There's a whole new set of things that you have to do. As my wife has joined me in this endeavor with our company, she's had to learn all this geology. Right? She never did that before. This is very new, right? And so grammar. Then you start getting the logical connections, right? You start making those connections in the next stage. And then in the third stage, you start seeing the synthesis of how all of this actually starts working together. So in this stage, we're still in a lot of grammar. as we're teaching our students with this kind of mayhem approach to mineralogy, right? We're not getting into the deep chemistry here, but we're starting to get into the fact that we have chemistry that's involved, and that something like minerals is not divorced from the other disciplines of science, never mind the other disciplines of knowledge, right? Because who was it that decided that we had to have a hardness test? Some guy named Mo. Except for his name isn't Mo. It's Mohs. M-O-H-S is the last name. It's not an apostrophe. And he was a German mineralogist. And what he wanted to do was create a system of determining hardness that anybody could do anywhere with basic equipment. So he just chose 10 minerals and labeled them 1 to 10 on the basis of this is really soft and this is really hard. So we have talc on one end, we have diamond on the other, and we have other very common minerals the rest of the way. So Mohs is a person. He's involved, and not just as a person who is a mineralogist, but you could then start thinking, okay, what else is going on in Germany at the same time, right? If you've got some historical connections and you want to figure out what's going on in 1883 or so when he invents this, you can be looking at that. This is pre-World War I, right? So we don't even have, what's going on politically? You can tie these in with historical components, right? Shape properties are things like crystal form and habit, right? How does the mineral grow in that component? And that's where you tie it back to you were given toys. What shapes did you build? What shapes could you build? Right? Because the types of shapes that you can build with the balls and the sticks are very different from the shapes that you can build with Legos, which are very different from the shapes that you can build with dominoes. Well, Legos and dominoes are a little more similar, but dominoes are much more fragile. Right? You can think of the Legos as being a much more rigid, hard type of material that has good covalent bonding, right? Whereas the dominoes, weak ionics, or maybe even hydrogen bonds, right? You could be thinking about that if you're trying to tie into other disciplines like chemistry. Mass-related properties, things like that. We've got mechanical properties, right? The hardness, the tenacity, cleavage, fracture, these are all terms that, or many of them are terms that we would use as we talk about this with our students. We have to be careful when we're talking about things like cleavage, right? When we're junior high especially. Like, okay, guys. So, you know, I tell my students, in fact, in the first day of lab when we are going to go through all of these in a two-hour period, because teaching college we've got 2 hours, I actually go over to the doors, I close them, I'm all sneaky and things like that. Like, all right, they don't know what we're doing here at Liberty. Okay, this lab is kind of secret because in this lab we're going to be dropping acid, we're going to go streaking, and we'll be looking at cleavage, right? And that's why we dropped acid first, because otherwise we'd never get through any of this. Sorry. Right. So you might not be able to say that in eighth grade without losing the entire class for the rest of the class and then being called into the principal on your own. The headmaster, no, you just can't do that. But nonetheless, right, you run into some terms that have meaning outside and you say, well, what does it mean to cleave? Right? The Bible says to cleave for the husband to the wife, right? So we have a meat cleaver, right? That's a big, huge, heavy knife. What does it do? It drives a straight line through things. So when we have a mineral that displays cleavage, we're talking about how it breaks. And then it breaks along these nice partings, these nice flat lines. And those are great to see with things like the micas. They're really good to see with things like the feldspars and stuff like that. Fracture. But you can tell your students about dropping acid and just see if they understand. Right, because I don't know. Yeah, I know. There's a different vintage, kids. Right. Also, half of the jokes are just for me. That's one of my rules in the class. It just keeps me going, right? So, other properties, of course, you've got odor and taste. If you've got sulfur around, it's great. There's some rocks that are really good with odor as well. If it smells like almonds, that's bad. That's arsenic. Don't taste that one. Yeah, certain millipedes will concentrate arsenic from the plants that they eat in their exoskeletons. So, Bear Grylls says, don't eat this one. And they're like, dude, I wasn't eating any of them. Taste, magnetism. Now, magnetism is something like our kit has a little magnet. There's only 3 minerals in the world that are magnetic. It's just 3. Magnetite. Go figure, right? The other two are so rare we never hear about them at all because it's just very, very unusual sorts of things. And there's a difference between something that is naturally magnetic, like a lodestone of magnetite, versus something that can be attracted to a magnet, like hematite can, or at least some forms of hematite, even some limonite, but not so much with that one. So reactions to acid, effervescence, things like that. So I just kind of went through our activity time there with basic mineral tests, right? Because now we then go through and we start, again, giving names to what we're doing. You know, this is what they do. This is how they inform us. Why is it that an acid reaction is important? What does it tell us about that mineral? If it tells us that it's calcite, then this ends up being one of the most important non-metallic minerals to us. Limestone, which is made up of calcite, is the reason why we have cement, both from ancient times all the way up through today, right? You can tie in the Roman roads, which were made with cement a lot of times, or at least used with a mortar, and the exact formula has been lost, which is unfortunate because we're not really sure how they made such good cement without the super high temperatures that we use to make cement today. Cement is one of the most energy-intensive building materials out there, so it's amazing that it's cheap, but it takes a huge amount of heat in order to bake out that calcite to the point where it will start to separate into other component parts. When you add water to it, it actually starts to form calcite all over again. And so actually, when you think of all these bridges, again, think about the connections around you. Think about the bridges that are here in Pittsburgh. They're sunk into the river with these big cement paddings. Adding more water to cement just makes more calcite. So long after the other parts of the bridge have rotted and gone away, that rock is still going to be in the river because all it does is get harder by absorbing more and more water. Cool, right? Neat stuff that we get to learn about. So those are some of the ways that we can kind of think about our observations, right? Our first observations are going to be about color, luster, crystal form, and maybe cleavage or fracture. We can see as you looked at some of these, you grouped them according to ones that kind of broke certain ways, other ones broke different ways, and then you get your hands-on tests with hardness, streak, magnetism, reaction, acid, or even cleavage and fracture, right? If you've got enough samples of stuff, you can have the kids hit stuff with hammers. That's fun. Sometimes under very controlled, heavily overseen conditions, handing kids with hammers or handing kids hammers can be kind of fun. One of the things that's also really good, I know you guys have, you know, typically 45-minute class periods or things like that, but you can arrange Saturday field trips, or at least it's possible. Quarries are a fantastic resource that are almost always available to you as teachers. Quarries are owned by big companies that usually have a geologist who works for them. And that geologist is often called upon to give quarry tours to kids, right? Public schools and things like that. You might not be able to go all the way down in the quarry. There's certain regulations about the quarries that make that difficult. But sometimes they'll haul up the quarry material and put it up top, and the kids can go whack at it with hammers for a while. That's really cool. I bring my students out to a quarry, and everybody gets to walk home with minerals. It's neat. It's really, really neat. Some of the quarries, especially limestone quarries, might have fossils in them. Whoa! Go find them, right? Go out there and go get them. So there's all kinds of opportunities there, and the quarries are often very, very quick to try and be good neighbors, right? They like to be well-known in the community and well thought of in the community, and they often have open-door policies. And quarries are typically only spaced about 30 to 40 miles apart from them, sometimes even less, because rock's heavy. And most of the cost with shipping rocks is the shipping part. It's not the rocks. For example, where I'm at in Lynchburg, Virginia, they charge $16 per ton for their rock. $16 a ton. But you got to move it, right? And the further that you have to move it, the more expensive that rock becomes. So at my campus at Liberty University, we're fortunate. We're like 2 miles away from the quarry. And with all the building that we're doing on campus, we're just constant source for them. But it means that the rock material is very, very inexpensive. But it also means that a quarry is probably very close to you, somewhere nearby, unless you live out on, say, the Atlantic coastal plain. And it gets a little bit more difficult. And you might have to drive about an hour to Richmond or something like that, the last spot where we have hard rock on the coastal plain. But quarries are all over the place. And there's data for that on things like the USGS website, US Geological Survey. They have something called MR data, usgs.mrdata, which isn't Mr. Data, although it sounds like it. It's the Mineral Resources Database. And you can find a map plot of all the quarries in the United States circa 2003. And since quarries don't kind of go away very quickly, it's probably all still there. And Google is a great way to have students identify quarries. Get them on a Google map, and quarries are always going to be these weird little oblong shapes that are kind of gray, right, from however many thousand feet in the air. And you can have them do activities like, okay, now at home, I want you to go onto Google. I want you to find the closest quarry to us. Or if you're going to do a quarry visit, start doing that ahead of time. So there we go. So with that, I'll take questions for a little bit, but we're just about done with our hour. Sorry I started 5 minutes late. We're trying to get table in over here with our goodies and stuff. But I'm over here at Cornerstone Educational Supply, the place with all the rocks, right? And you know, love to chat with you. One thing that I didn't get a chance to put on this slide is that tomorrow, for those of you who are here, tomorrow afternoon at 3:15, I'd like to meet with any of you who are interested in high school science. For those of you who are high school or middle school, eighth grade, teaching earth science, I and several other colleagues in chemistry and biology and physics are interested in putting together a new science series, a new high school textbook that is geared for classical students, possibly further afield from that. But I know the materials that are out there, and I know that better can be done. But in order for me to make something better, I need to know what you think is better, right? What you guys would want. So if, for those of you who might be interested, stop by. We're going to be in the three seasons. They have more than that here in Pittsburgh. They have all four. Sorry, there's the restaurant, and then there's the lounge in front of the restaurant. And so 3:15, I'll be down there. Soft drinks are on me. Only soft drinks. Soft drinks are on me downstairs tomorrow at 3:15. If you'd like to meet and talk about what you would want to have, Three Rivers. Thank you. Three Rivers. That's right. Go figure. It's Pittsburgh. Three Rivers. I want to hear from you guys. We have not started writing yet, but we are in the planning stages. And what would be the earth science, physics, chemistry, biology series that you would die to have? Let me know. All right, any questions? Oh, you guys can bolt. That's all right. Enjoy. Thank you very much. Thanks for your participation. Thanks for being here.